Hello everyone, my name is Stuart Broom. I'm the Global Head of Cybersecurity and Data Protection Law at DWS. And with me is Hazel Grant.
Hi everyone, my name is Hazel Grant. I'm the Head of Privacy at Field Fisher. So we're going to make a start on our webinar right now, and Stuart's going to start us off with the Lloyd and Google case. Over to you, Stuart.
Thanks ever so much, Hazel. So Lloyd and Google, a landmark decision of the Supreme Court in November 2021. And it's telling us a huge amount about the future of class actions in the UK. Well, actually, it's an English and Welsh decision, but it will probably have further effects. So let's have a little look at the factual matrix, if we can. Just a few minutes about this to set the scene, if we can move the slides forward. This is a case about the Safari workaround. So back in 2012, Google developed some script that was embedded into websites. And what would happen is if you hit that website, viewed that website, for example, moved your mouse over that script, it would cause an effect on your iPhone or your iPad. And that effect was to overcome any cookie blocking that you put in place. So do not track settings, sometimes called. And then Google was able to set a cookie on the device that supported the double click ad network system. So that's basically what the case is all about. It's about the setting of cookies without permission, the obtaining of browser generated information, and the lawfulness of that and liability for those actions. Just some key points about the areas of law here. So in our jurisdiction, the setting of cookies is covered by the Privacy and Electronic Communications Regulations, sometimes called PECA, from 2003. They've been amended. That's Regulation 6 we'll look at. And the basic point is, if a cookie is not strictly necessary, they can only be set on someone's device, their iPhone, their tablet, with their consent. And we've also got the Data Protection Act 1998, almost repealed in full and replaced by the 2018 Act. But if we were to look in the schedules of that legislation, we find the data protection principles and the rules on lawfulness of processing of personal data, which includes the consent rule. So that's basically the factual matrix that applies to this case and the legal matrix that applies to the setting of cookies and the use of personal data that's obtained as a result. Now, the Safari workaround came to public attention due to a researcher in an American university. A lot of fallout in the United States, and eventually Google entered into a settlement with the Federal Trade Commission, essentially the US consumer protection regulator, if you like, a voluntary settlement to pay $22.5 million. And that was all done without admission of fault or admission of liability, the way it works in the States. There were also other settlements with state attorney generals, and that they came to another $17 million. So, you know, quite a bit of financial and regulatory, you know, concern around this matter. Now, the case moved across the Atlantic, and this led to the development of group litigation in this country, known as the Vidal-Hall case. And the Vidal-Hall case established that Section 13 of the old Data Protection Act 1998 enables a person to recover compensation for a contravention of the legislation if they have suffered damage or distress. So the way that case ended was to lead to an amendment of the Data Protection Act to remove a condition to the award of compensation that a person must always suffer pecuniary loss before they can recover compensation for distress. So as a result of Vidal-Hall, the basic position under the Data Protection Act then, and essentially under the Data Protection Act now, is you just need to be distressed in order to recover compensation for a contravention of the Data Protection Act. You don't have to prove that you've suffered pecuniary loss, such as financial damage. You just need to show that you're distressed. Obviously, if you do suffer financial damage, you can recover compensation if that results from a contravention of the legislation as well. So that's Vidal Hall. That all came to a head in 2015. And that seemed to be the end of matters until Mr. Lloyd commenced litigation about the same subject matter. Now, his claim was brought as a representative action under the civil procedure rules, and the civil procedure rules govern the conduct of civil litigation in England and Wales. And inside the civil procedure rules, part 19, are the rules on essentially class actions. And part 19, rule 6, contains the rule about representative actions. So he commenced litigation under the representative action rule. But he had an option. He could have commenced litigation under the group litigation rule, which is found in CPR 19.11. And we'll come on to the significance of that in a moment. So representative action under the civil procedure rules, and the claim was for compensation under Section 13 of the Data Protection Act, which, as we've spoken about, is concerned with damage or distress. But the way the case was pleaded and pursued in the court was for Mr. Lloyd to say that the compensation that should be awarded on what's known as a loss of control basis. Now, the idea of loss of control compensation is that a person should be contravened for a mere contravention of law, not simply or not as a result of the suffering of damage or distress that results from a contravention of law. In other words, some legal principles and some legal potential protections are so important that they should be compensatable without any damage or distress being suffered simply because of contravention of law. And this idea of loss of control damages in the privacy ecosystem within which the Data Protection Act is connected operates and has operated within sister and related causes of action, particularly the tort of misuse of private information. So he was claiming loss of control, a compensation, because there had been a mere contravention of the Data Protection Act that was compensatable per se. And in addition to that, he argued that the way compensation should be calculated was on a user damages basis. Now, the idea of user damages, quite straightforward, that sometimes there can be an interference with a right that deprives a person of an economic advantage, an economic position. And had that interference been negotiated rather than the interference simply occurring, a person would be able to negotiate a fee, a price to allow the use, for example, of their asset. And we see this within cases around trespass to land, where land is a valuable asset. And if a person wanted to use your land, you could rent it to them. And therefore, if they were to move onto your land without the permission, you have lost the ability to use the land economically in your interest. And therefore, the concept of user damages applies. So that's the factual matrix. So if we can just move on to the next slide, and we'll have a look at the ratio of the case. So the decision that was reached by the Supreme Court. So the first point to understand is that the Supreme Court have not permitted loss of control compensation to be awarded under Section 13 of the Data Protection Act. Section 13 of the Data Protection Act says, and I'm broadly paraphrasing, that where there is a contravention of the Act, if a person suffers damage or distress as a result of that compensation, they should be that contravention, they should be entitled to compensation. So what we see is cause and effect, contravention of law leading to an outcome, damage or distress. So we have to have that flow of causation and causality, if you like. Mr. Lloyd was trying to do something very different. He was trying to say, by using the loss of control idea, that the contravention was compensatable by itself. So you did not need to go further and prove the causation of damage or distress. And the Supreme Court was not willing to allow that construction. This was a matter of statutory interpretation, that the wording of Section 13 did not permit of compensation for mere contravention. Therefore, it did not permit of loss of control damages. So that's the first piece that we learn in respect of this judgment. You can only suffer, only recover compensation if there's causation of damage and distress within the Section 13 Data Protection Act environment. Another point that we learned within this judgment is that there is a threshold in any event to compensation. So distress has to be more than petty and trivial. So if a person suffers trivial and petty distress as a result of a contravention of the Data Protection Act, that should not be compensatable. So there is a threshold that needs to be overcome for distress compensation to be awarded. We don't know exactly where that threshold is yet, and that'll be established in subsequent cases. But there have been recent High Court decisions that have said that, you know, the mere misdirection of an email doesn't cause enough distress to get over that threshold. So we'll see where the bar lands in due course. Now the next point that we take out of the judgment is really about representative actions themselves, and really the underlying strategy that Mr. Lloyd was deploying. So representative actions are only allowed where the group or the class of people affected have the same interest. So they have to have the same interest. In contrast, group litigation, again, class actions, if you like, can take place where people have common or related interests, which are not exactly the same. So in order to make this case work under the representative action procedure, he had to show that every single person affected by the safari workaround had the same interest. And because this case was about liability in quantum, it meant the same interest in liability and the same interest in quantum. In order to get to that position and to make it arguable, Mr. Lloyd was saying that the same interest arises from the loss of control idea, that because loss of control can be awarded for mere contravention, we all have the same loss of control. And in terms of getting to the same interest as well, the user damages idea applied, because he said that you could take the amount that Google had made economically, divide it by the class of people, 4 million, and they all get, you know, 750 quid each or whatever it might have been. So he was trying to shoehorn user damages and loss of control inside the representative procedure so as to end up with a result of everyone having the same interest, which permitted the use of the representative procedure. The Supreme Court were having none of that. They were having none of that because the construction of Section 13 does not allow a compensation for loss of control. Therefore, damage and distress is not a uniform issue. Everyone in the group needs to be individually assessed for purposes of damage or distress. So, for example, one person might go onto a website where the JavaScript was placed and surf over it on one occasion, and that might have led to a cookie being dropped only momentarily, because subsequently they deleted the cookie. But another person might have been going on multiple websites time and time and time again. The cookies could have been used for gathering a lot of it browser-generated information, and therefore that the invasion of their data protection space is greater in the second case than in the first case. So by looking at the idea of Section 13 requiring the proof of causation of damage and distress, you're left with a conclusion that is never a uniform matter. Therefore, damage and distress is not the same across the class of people. And therefore, because it is not the same, it cannot, the representative procedure cannot be used for damage and distress cases, at least insofar as litigation that extends beyond liability into quantum. So bringing that all together, what we end up with, but very, very simply, is this, is you can't use Section 13 for loss of control compensation claims. And if we can move the slides forward just to look at these implications. But if you did want to run a loss of control claim, then you could run it under the tort of misuse of private information, a very, very different claim to the Data Protection Act claim that Mr. Lloyd brought. Theoretically, it seems possible on the face of the judgment that you could use a representative procedure for liability-only litigation under Section 13 of the Data Protection Act. The Supreme Court have left that open. You can't extend it into the quantum bit where the damage and distress piece requires an individualized assessment, but they've left open a theoretical possibility that maybe you could bring a liability-only case under the Data Protection Act under the representative procedure. Theoretically possible. People are struggling to actually identify a practical use case that will apply, but let's not ignore the inventiveness of claimant solicitors and that they may get there in due course. Loss of control damages, as we said, could be pursued under tort of misuse of private information cases. There's a very famous case of Galati, mentioned on the previous slide, that talks about that. User damages, this idea that a person should be compensated for the loss of an asset or interference with an asset, this is really interesting because on the face of the judgment, it seems possible that the user damages idea could be used both within a Data Protection Act claim and a tort of misuse of private information claim, albeit the civil procedure rules need to apply in terms of whether it's representative actions or group litigation. But what we can certainly take from it is that there seems to be scope for group litigation on a liability and quantum basis under Section 13 of the Data Protection Act to pursue distress compensation on a user damages basis. And if that can be pursued, it's really fascinating because inside the data protection environment, for many years, people have speculated about the idea that data is personal data is an economic asset and people should be compensated for interferences with data as an economic asset, not just as a personal right or a privacy issue. If that can be sustained, then of course that will be a matter of great interest for the claimant law firm, claimant management, the compensation industry. And it'll also be of great interest for organizations that essentially monetize data, particularly within the use of ad networks, as was happening within this case. It seems to me highly likely that claimant law firms that are operating in this space will try and push this boundary forward and see in a future case of data grabbing, particularly in a monetized ad network environment, that compensation should be based around the economic gain that the business took by grabbing the personal data and using it to sell ads. So I think that's going to be a fascinating way forward. In terms of the wider implications, the last point before I pass over to Hazel to tell us about SCCs and international transfers, it really relates to how we're viewing the trajectory of litigation. This case is certainly not the end of class actions for the Data Protection Act and related matters, not at all. We will see class actions, probably group litigation orders for the Data Protection Act and for the under the tort of misuse of private information and for breach of confidentiality for many, many years to come until there is a further restriction of the ability to do so by the Supreme Court. So we're certainly not away from that environment. Equally, this does not impact at all on individual claims. So individuals who don't take part in a group, so myself as an individual, I can still pursue my compensation claims individually. And the final impact is really about the split of the court. In Lloyd and Google, Lloyd lost in the High Court, won in the Court of Appeal, lost in the Supreme Court. And we've seen that pattern of different points of view in those higher courts, Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court in other cases. What seems to be emerging is the Court of Appeal seems to be much more favourable about or better disposed to compensation claims run by consumers against big businesses. In other words, the Court of Appeal seem to be, you know, with the justice of the case, whereas the Supreme Court seems to be restricting these cases on a policy basis. And of course, not every case gets the Supreme Court. Most cases will end at the Court of Appeal if they ever get there. And of course, the Court of Appeal judges may end up as Supreme Court judges in due course. And of course, the Court of Appeal judges may influence the judges further down the judicial hierarchy. So the fact that the judiciary is split is something that claimant law firms and the compensation industry are going to take comfort from, because it is not saying, this case is not saying, that all senior judges are against large-scale group litigation. So there we go. I hope that was of help and of interest. And I'm now going to pass over to Hazel, who's going to tell us about SCCs. Hazel, over to you.
Thanks very much, Stuart. Hello, everyone. So as mentioned at the start of this webinar, I'm Hazel Grant. I'm the head of privacy at Field Fisher, and we have been spending pretty much the last 6 months dealing with the new SCCs. So I thought that that's what I would talk about. Basically, what do you need to know about the new SCCs? So let's move on to the first substantive slide that I have. And if I can do that myself. Yes. So I wanted to give you the big picture. Let's take it from the top. We have some new EU-based, so issued by the European Commission, standard contractual clauses, SCCs. They've been around since June. Your key deadlines now are that you must implement these new EU SCCs for all EU data transfers by essentially the end of December next year, i.e. the 27th of December 2022. You must have migrated all of your contracts across to the new SCCs. However, in the interim, right now, you have to be using the new EU SCCs when you have new contracts. You cannot sign up the old EU SCCs. What's the difference with the new EU SCCs? Well, we'll go into the modular approach in a minute, but at a very high level, it's not a seismic change. We have the standard contractual clauses with improved languages, language in certain clauses, with different appendices, with improved optional language, which is a little bit more commercial. For example, it allows things like a docking clause to allow you to bring in new parties. So a moment ago, I mentioned the modular approach. This is the really big change. If you've had to deal with the SCCs in the past, you'll be aware that there are essentially two types of standard contractual clauses. There was the controller to controller transfer, a set of clauses where you have an EU-based controller transferring data to a controller outside the EU. And you had a similar set of clauses where you had an EU-based controller transferring to a non-EU-based processor. The modular approach effectively is one set of clauses, but with different modules that apply to different types of transfers. We have, again, controller to controller and controller to processor. Those are understood. We've dealt with those in the past. But what's new is a processor to processor or processor to subprocessor. So, for example, if you had an EU-based processor who was using a subprocessor in the US, the EU-based processor could use Module 3 to cover that data transfer of the data from the EU-based processor to a sub-processor in the US. Similarly, we now have a Module 4, which is processor to controller. This would cover a situation where you have, say, an EU SaaS provider, an EU processor, that has been engaged by a US controller. In that situation, the processor will undoubtedly receive some data from the US controller, carry out some processing in the EU, and then need to send it back to the US. Previously, there was no simple, convenient, sensible way to allow that processor to export the data back to the US to the controller. Now we have Module 4. What else is in the new EU SECs that's of significance? Well, because of the case of Schrems II, raising concerns about public authority access to EU-hosted or EU-generated data, we have some new obligations on both parties with respect to public authority access requests. At a very high level, this clause covers an obligation on both parties to confirm that there's no reason to believe that the laws in the destination country will be problematic, i.e. will lead to these types of requests, and that the importer should notify any types of requests like this and to challenge where there are reasonable grounds to do so. Okay, let's move on to the next slide and a few more details. So I thought it might be sensible to sort of, at a very high level, list the questions that clients are asking us about these new EU SECs. Probably the most frequent question is, well, these new EU SECs are really quite long. Could I just incorporate them by reference and save myself pages and pages in my contracts? I personally don't see why you shouldn't be able to do that. I think that it is a choice. Some people like to have the whole of their particular module repeated in their contract, so it's ease of reference or reading, so you can see all the clauses in one place. Some people don't like to expand the number of pages of their contract, so they just want to incorporate by reference. If you do incorporate by reference, and we do see a lot of clients doing that, you need to be careful that all the optional choices are made so that it's obvious, because there are approximately, I don't know, 5 or 6 clauses where you have to express a particular option to apply to that module. And we will talk about some of those in a moment, but you have to make sure that you've specified what your choice is. Another question that clients ask is, well, what about the UK? The UK at the moment, officially, you have to use the old EU SECs because those are the only ones that apply. And in fact, the ICO on their website has given you a sort of handy set of the changes that you would need to make to the old EU SECs to make them apply to the UK. The ICO has actually issued a consultation on our own UK version of the SECs. That consultation includes the ability to have an appendix that will anglicise the new EU SECs. So essentially, the ICO is offering a set of standard contractual clauses which are specific to the UK. It's also offering effectively a one pager which will make the changes to the new EU SECs to make them work in the UK. So where it says member state, read UK, where it says a particular regulator, read ICO. That is not yet final. We must wait, I think, probably until early next year to see what the ICO have to say on that. Now, I mentioned a moment ago some options. Particular options that people have a quandary about are, first of all, that under Clause 13, you have to select the appropriate EU regulator. This will depend on how the GDPR is applying to your data transfer or your data. So it can be quite difficult to specify this in advance, especially if, for example, you are setting out the use of the EU SECs in some standard contract that you wish to apply to all of your customers. So we can find that some clients will make a sort of circular reference to say, instead of saying my EU regulator is this particular regulator, it will be as set out in clause 13. Go read it in clause 13. It will depend on how the data is being transferred and who's using it. Another thing that can cause some concern is selection of a member state law and a member state court. It is possible that you could choose a different member state law to a different court. I'm not really sure why you would do that. I think you would want to choose the same state law and the same court. Probably it will depend on where your EU headquarters is and perhaps where you have knowledge of the legal system and you have some in-house lawyers who could assist you if you ever got to litigation. That is actually a choice. So you could in fact choose a different country. So a number of our clients might well choose Ireland because they are perhaps speak English and they have some understanding of the legal system there. Then we get on to the appendices. Now, as I've put here, this is easier said than done. This is where it becomes a little more tricky. I personally feel that in the new EU SCCs, a lot more detail is expected by the new EU SCCs. So, for example, in the security schedule, there is a long list of suggested topics that you should be covering in the security schedule. It's not mandated, but I think it probably would be helpful for you to follow that suggested list and put a paragraph next to each topic and say how you are meeting that suggested security procedure or practice to enhance the security of the data that's being transferred. The next point to make is that I think more specificity is expected in this set of EU SCCs. So there's more detail about the data that is being transferred, data retention expectations, things like that. So if you have an old set of EU SCCs, if you read across from the appendices in the old set of EUCs to the new set of EUCs, you will find that you need more information. It is not simply a read across from the old set. So let's move on to the next slide. So, no talk on standard contractual clauses is really complete without mentioning transfer impact assessments. It is probably fair to say that EU regulators expect all controllers to be carrying out transfer impact assessments, TIAs, before a transfer so that they understand the risks that the data will undergo or face in that transfer, and to assist in completing the standard contractual clauses to make sure that there are correct measures in there to protect the data. You will find all of this information set out in the European Data Protection Board's EDPB guidance on international data transfers. In practice, what is happening is that transfer impact assessments can be extremely time consuming and costly. And so I am finding that a lot of clients are concentrating on their standard contractual clauses and ignoring for now TIAs or completing them after the standard contractual clauses. This is because a transfer impact assessment needs to analyze the law in the destination country, what are the risks, what's the type of data, what sort of supplementary measures could be put in place to mitigate any of those risks. It's actually quite a comprehensive piece of work. We have some clients who are looking at pro forma TIAs, which set out the law in the destination country, but they still need to be personalized to the actual transfer. So you have to look at the actual data and the processes that will be carried out on the data. It's also worth mentioning that the EDPB guidance that I mentioned a moment ago had two use cases, two examples at the end of the guidance, where it could not suggest supplementary measures to protect the transfer. Essentially, it said, we don't know what to do. If the data is going like this, we don't think it can be protected. And those were where there were cloud or other providers viewing the data in the clear, or where there was remote access to personal data. And this is a significant worry, obviously, for cloud service providers. However, in the final version of the EDPB guidance, there was a glimmer of hope, a particular paragraph that says, where the law is not applied in practice, then supplementary measures are not required. So you could go through a transfer impact assessment, carry out all the analysis, but include some references to say, actually, although this law exists in practice, in this sector, in for this client, for this type of data, these access requests from the government do not happen, and therefore supplementary measures are not required. So on to the final slide. What are some things to watch out for? A couple of points that are slightly odd questions that come up every now and then. First of all, in June, the EU issued a second set of standard contractual clauses, which are not the standard contractual clauses. They're actually Article 28 controller to processor terms. So please don't get caught out by those. When you go searching for the new EU standard contractual clauses, you will find a couple of sets that were issued in June. One of them is essentially Article 28, just the terms that you would expect between a controller and processor. The other is actually the international data transfer terms that you will be looking for. And secondly, we do still see clients, obviously, especially US clients, who are referring to the Privacy Shield, and they are maintaining that. I think they see that as something that is perhaps for twofold reasons. First of all, helpful to their US customer base to show that they are following a comprehensive data privacy practice, and potentially because they hope that they might perhaps be grandfathered into an updated version of Privacy Shield at some stage. So it's worth maintaining Privacy Shield, but you do still see it. It is unfortunately of no use if you are looking to rely on it for transfers from the EU or from Switzerland, or indeed the UK at the moment. So those were all the points that I wanted to cover under international data transfers. And I think it's probably back to Stuart now for a little bit of discussion between us.
Thanks, Hazel. That was absolutely excellent. And as it was going through and I was just making notes, I mean, that one of the things that was going through my mind is, it does feel like a huge amount of bureaucracy, potentially for low volumes of meaningful legal regulatory risk. And what I'm really driving at is that the sheer volume of transfers is such that most organizations who are doing it are not going to really come into conflict with a legal regime. So I was just wondering about the, you know, perspectives around that as to, you know, how much legal risk is there in this topic for entities?
Yeah, well, I think, Stuart, if you remember back in the mists of time when we were dealing with the directive, it actually took a number of years before there was any form of enforcement on international data transfers. And when it came down to it, the enforcement was of a few cases in Spain and Germany, as I remember it. But I think this time round, we're seeing a slightly different approach from regulators. I think there are going to be a bit more hard line. I could imagine them focusing in on service providers, for example, the cloud service providers, because they can effectively go after a few providers and protect slash enforce a large number of data transfers and therefore protect a lot of data, rather than, for example, an intra-group agreement where one business is sending its HR data back to the US. There's not a big regulatory bonus in enforcing in that situation because it is, quote, just one group of HR, employees or candidates, etc. So I can see them having a slightly different focus and being more interested in what are the service providers doing and what are the clients of service providers doing in terms of protecting international data transfers.
Yeah, that makes sense, doesn't it? So the cloud service provider is a nexus between multiple parties and obviously multiple territories. So go in there. I mean, in that scenario, let's say my organization, or you know, in this case, or my client rather, is working with cloud service provider, stuffing stuff in the cloud, and the regulators go, concentrate on them. Are you seeing it that they will expect the cloud service provider to almost facilitate compliance through standard terms and conditions? So basically, as long as you the controller who's moving to cloud is clever and signs up for their T&Cs, you can just be in the right space. Is it that kind of model?
Yeah, I mean, I'm seeing a lot of the cloud service providers effectively trying to present it on a plate to their clients and saying, here are the standard contractual clauses modified for our products, our services. Now, I wouldn't say that the service providers are providing a completed transfer impact assessment, because I don't think they can do that. I think the controller has to do that. But they might be providing a partially completed one, or a white paper, something similar like that, where it gets the customer, the client, at least 50% of the way there. Because I think if you don't do that, then essentially, other service providers will. People will start to shop around, I suspect, and find a service provider that is providing a sort of compliance package that says, here are the SCCs, and here's at least part of a transfer impact assessment to meet that. And we are actually seeing down the chain different processors on the chain asking for a partially completed transfer impact assessment from their sub-processor, for example, so they get some of the information that they need.
I'm sorry, the TIA in a box idea, you sort of refer to templates. I mean, my guess on that is, give it a few years and it will be something that you will be able to template. It's about enough granularity about the use cases, isn't it? And enough granularity about what's special about my characteristics.
Yeah.
And, eventually, you can imagine. I mean, it might be law firms, it might be the know-how providers, or techcos even. We might get to a happy stage where we can start following the questionnaires and outbound. So it could be a sort of an interim period of frustration and extra admin perhaps.
I think that's right. I mean, we are putting together and we have done pro forma TIAs for clients. But what we're finding is there's a range of responses from clients. Some clients will then spend a lot of time and effort completing the TIA. Others, when they get it, will realize how much time and effort needs to be put in and go, I can't, I just don't have the time or the capability to do that. So I think to your point, this will gradually mature into TIAs where clients spend a lot of time and effort on it, and other ones where effectively they almost say, I'm a medium risk business, give me your medium risk TIA and the supplementary measures I need to do. Or I'm a low risk business, give me your low risk TIA, please.
I suppose there's going to be organisations, isn't there, small to medium enterprises that
yes.
Often when we talk about that category of the economy, people sort of can sometimes default to think that SMEs don't operate globally, or internationally. And of course, that's not always the case, is it? So that feels that there's a fair bit of burden there that could be lifted with, sort of a templated approach. So I hope you get.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And indeed, some of the more innovative services might be in that SME area, and in a way they might be the ones that need the most help, because someone is providing AI consulting from his home in Miami or something like that. That might be the sort of thing that does need a TIA and does need a relatively sensible approach in order to make that workable. Turning to your presentation, Stuart, I mean, if you got your crystal ball out right now, what do you think will be the impact of Lloyd and Google? Where will it take us? Where are we going to end up in 2 years' time or 5 years' time? What do you think is going to happen?
So it's a great question, and I think a lot of the answer lies in the structures of the, let's call it the litigation industry, or the compensation I was describing before. So I'm seeing two types of actor that's involved in it, and essentially in a pure for profit play, if you like. So there are quite a few speculative law firms that they've just jumped in and they're borrowing template letters, and you read the stuff that comes in and it's just rubbish. It just, you know, do a lot of defense work and go, oh my word, what's all that about? And then you've got other law firms. So without naming the firms involved in Lloyd and Google, they're both excellent firms, aren't they? But if you think about the claimant firm there, there are lots of firms of that ilk and that character who are blue chip, fantastic lawyers inside the practices, and look very, very different to the first category that I was describing. Mm-hmm. I think it will depend on their reaction. That's the second category. And I think they've got the intellectual chops and the skills and the motivations to work the way through all of this. So I'm sort of seeing Lloyd and Google and what it means for the litigation market. It's more of a maze than it is a brick wall. You may not actually know, do I go left, do I go right? Is there a dead end over there? But there is a way through. And I think the sophisticated claimant law firms will get there. So I think there's that's half of it. So that was in the idea. That's in the idea of the people in it for pure economics. Mm-hmm. If you look at the other side, and they do meld, it's not a bright line distinction, but the other side is in it for justice sort of stuff, in it for the privacy activist route. Lloyd and Google was quite interesting. It was a merger of both. It was a very famous consumer champion, but it's backed with I think it's backed by litigation funders. So you've got the justice bit with the economic bit. So that's a special recipe. What the Supreme Court have left open around representative actions purely on liability under Section 13. Yeah, so where's the use case? If we're actually going to find one, it will be the justice person who is very, very happy to get a representative win on liability and let anyone else pick up the baton and do what they want with quantum. Whereas if you've got the litigation funders involved, why would they do the liability only and do all that investment and let someone else then reap the reward? So I think that we may see through that maze the pure play justice privacy activist, potentially endowed with charitable donations or other endowments, but doesn't have to deliver an economic return, that they could move that the remainder of the representative action forward for the DPA. I think that's possible. Another way of looking at it, I was speaking to a friend of mine who is, one of these very, very strong, pucker claimant law firm solicitors. And we were talking about metaphors, and it's a pretty good one. The one we came up with, and it's obvious at the beginning, was it's a bit like, boxers and stuff like that. But, the best boxers are ones that have, hit the canvas and they've been floored by hard punches. And they learn from those painful experiences. And the thing that drives the quality, I think, of the top end claimant litigators, is the fact that they actually take the losses as well. For the lower end ones, they can't survive the losses because the cash flow bust. They don't get the cash flow. So I think that's how it will shape out, really. I think you'll see the continuation of large scale litigation, including potentially underrepresented proceedings, but it'll be better quality than some of the claims I'm seeing right now. Some of them are just games of bluff, to be honest, rather than games of jurisprudence.
Oh wow! Okay. And can I kind of ask you of some example cases? I mean, obviously don't name names, but some situations where this would apply. I mean, in your presentation, you said, you know, ad tech, some sort of use slash abuse of tracking is a fairly obvious one. And you could see how that would drum up interest from the quotes activist end quotes, and also potentially the funders. But outside that, I mean, is this something we'll see from, I don't know, consumer organizations or patient organizations or patient groupings? What do you think?
Yeah, it's a good question. So we're talking really about the user damages basis of calculation. I mean, yeah. I've lost that. Or, you know, there was something that was negotiated, you know, there was a negotiable idea. And the parallel that the jury, you know, you've seen is the idea that in an ad tech environment, you see a very, very close proximity between the economic value of your data and the economic gain of the ad tech industry. So it's really obvious, that one. The last one that you mentioned, I think, is, you know, is a really good one to look at, which would be where, you know, personal data is used in, you know, the health research environment, you know, pharmaceuticals, etc. You know, could there be, you know, compliance deficits there that, you know, the data is integral to, you know, to the product? You know, that would be interesting. Albeit, you know, we've not yet got to a stage where people look at pharma the way they look at ad tech. You know, it's a very, very different thing. I think if there is going to be a general explosion around user damages, I think the argument might be connected to the idea that your ability to breach my data protection right, or indeed my privacy right, if it was done down the MPI route, is connected to some form of want of investment. You know, you did shortcuts, you know, you didn't do the right thing. So think about your TIAs and how they're going to be very, very expensive. So there might be a way of saying that a business that operates at a particular level of, you know, compliance, you know, at an appropriate level of compliance, you know, carries, you know, an economic burden of whatever pounds it may be. This organization was investing at a lower level and taking the, you know, taking the benefit of its non-compliance and saving its cost. And the reason why I think that's interesting is because, of course, that's how the financial penalty regime really is intended to work, with where, you know, financial penalties, you know, the 4% stuff is all around, you know, the regulatory principle of disgorgement. So you've got discipline, so you discipline by punishing a fine, deter, that's the, you know, the second D, and the third is disgorgement. And the disgorgement idea is, say, you know, we shall take away from you the economic advantage that you took by, you know, your poor behavior. And if the regulatory system, you know, increases the output around financial penalties, you know, we're really moving now, as you know, but not yet in a, you know, an industry, we'll get there in a few years' time. I think that's where I'd be looking, is going, okay, so what are the regulators doing? They're disgorging this amount, which tends to suggest there's an economic gain that they're disgorging. I should share in that economic gain, the compliance deficit, and then home in on those cases, and then follow the regulator. And so, I'd be willing to put a bet on. I mean, that's where I was going. You know, I used to do claimant work back in the day. Yeah. If I wanted to go claimant, I'd go down that route and see, you know, try and mirror the fines a little bit and go, oh, they've gone for 17 mil. I want to slice that 17 mil, or whatever it may be.
Interesting. So then I've got this is just me being very selfish. Since you're here, I'm going to ask you these questions anyway. So there are kind of two follow-up questions that I have. Let me just write them down so I don't forget them. The first one is a bit of a legalistic one. So I think I'm right in saying that this was a case under Section 13 of the DPA. Can we read across what was said under effectively old law into the new DPA? You think we can? Yeah.
So, you know, the Section 13 ideas, you know, basically carried across.
Yes.
And the you know, the contravention that is causative of, you know, damage, and then the Vidal Hall clarification that was made to the old Act, you know, was really ironed out with, you know, the GDPR made it crystal clear that damage is material, non-material. Yeah, so it definitely reads across into the current legislation in terms of, you know, those ideas of causation of damage and distress, damage or distress,
yes. Good. I thought that was the case. Now, the next question was really about timing. I mean, how long has this case been running? It's like years, isn't it?
It's a fantastic point. This case hasn't been running that long. You know, it was 2013 or something like that.
Okay.
You know, the issue, but your underlying point is spot on. What this case is, it's been running since 2011. It's run in various guises. You know, the FTC guys, the state attorney generals, then Vidal Hall, then this. It's the idea, and you know, lots of entities really don't understand this. As you know, we think about limitation periods, and we think about the golden hours after an incident, and we have a very, you know, we have a very rigid way of looking at time and the time it takes for problems to materialise. When you look at the really big ones, and the most, you know, the best example is phone hacking.
True.
Yeah, when I was at the bar, that's the thing that got me into this. When I was at the bar, you know, and I left the bar in 2000, you know, the very end of the last 3 years that actually, you know, made me think I'm going to become a solicitor, because in those days, you know, there were no solicitors. It was you, and there was, you know, Rosemary and Sheila, and, you know, Chris Miller. There's a few of us doing it, you know, Ruth, but there weren't many. So you couldn't get work from instructing solicitors, so I had to become an instructing solicitor, but I wouldn't have got to that idea if I'd not seen phone hacking, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And the entire ecosystem of phone hacking was something that I was dealing with and advising on back in the late 90s. And that ecosystem was about, you know, private investigators, evidence being acquired for litigation, evidence being acquired for subprime financial, you know, debt collection, and of course for journalistic purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, wow, I just ended up, you know, at the bar just getting all of this work and then transitioning to solicitor and, you know, did loads and loads and loads of it. And that's, you know, where I made my reputation really in that space of litigation. But the point being is that phone hacking thing that really materialized as a public scandal was in 2010. That's when it became truly scandalous. There were criminal prosecutions in 2005, 2006. But the tail went right back into the early 1990s. And that's this issue, I think, that we see with this matter, that they go back these and then we see a problem, you know, materialise. So I think that's how I kind of look at it. You know, you can say that there could be a decade, and you could have a decade's worth of latent damage that materialises as, you know, a litigation problem. And if we, you know, we amplify that and scale it up, you know, then we can see there is, you know, potentially a lot of latent peril in the economy. If those claimant law firms want to take the thing, I said.
Exactly. I mean, this is the thing, isn't it? It's just, as you say, it's a very long tail. If this issue arises for a particular sector or for a particular business, this is a massive millstone round their neck for a decade.
I mean, ad tech, you know, plainly, it's, you know, this was part of the ad tech thing, wasn't it? Vidal Hall was part of the thing. And there are so many critics of it now, aren't there? You know, you see people going to the European Parliament and giving speeches and this, that, and the other. And someone will do to that what, you know, they did to phone hacking, and they're not going to be the privacy lawyers. They're not going to be the community that we knock around it. If there's going to be another community, to go, wow, I see it, bang, yeah, I can make that work. Guys, you know, the characters who worked in phone hacking, I mean, once that really dies off and it's still going on, move into that space, folks. You know, you're going to fill your boots. I think we might see some of that.
Wow, there's plenty of work left for us till retirement, Stuart.
Anyway, Hazel, I think we're probably out of time now. I thought your talk was brilliant. I really did, and you know, I learned a lot, and I've really enjoyed spending the hour with you. It's been nice to see you again.
Yes. And
our audience.
Likewise, I very much enjoyed your session. Very interesting.
Brilliant. Well, it's good to see you, Hazel.
Yes, and you.
Good to see you.
Yeah. Good luck, everyone, with your SCCs.